What is going on, everybody? Jamie Shaw here, Absolute Basketball Podcast. I can't express to you guys how excited I'm having Andre Gray on the show with us today. He has an unbelievable interview and a great wealth of knowledge here. Andre, how you doing?
I'm wonderful. Thanks for having me on. It's crazy. Like, to think about, I think I was your first Zoom call.
Yep.
The pandemic started, and now I might retire after this one. I'm done. I've done about 10 of these things now, and people probably tired of hearing my monotone ad. So
no, I know they're not. I know people are super excited about hearing your knowledge. I mean, every time that you come on anything, it's like, oh man, Dre's the best. Dre's amazing. Dre, he's you know, your reputation's unbelievable.
There must be some bad coaches out there if I'm one.
Not at all, man. Not at all. It is. You have an infectious personality. I think anybody who follows you on Twitter sees that as well. And obviously, anybody who ever talks to you sees that too. So,
yes, sir. Well, thanks for coming, Jamie.
Well, on here, I want to deep dive into you. How you got to where you are? What makes you tick? And how you got to be? In the position you're in. Starting off, I guess, Elizabethtown, North Carolina, east of 95. Right between Fayetteville and Wilmington, a town of 3,500 people you come from. How did you get into basketball?
It's funny. I grew early. You know, my path as a player is pretty different. I'm not one of those guys who grew up playing sports. Most people don't realize I actually was born in New York, and I spent my first 11 years of my life up there, and I didn't play any sports whatsoever. I got drawn into sports based on one of my neighbors. He was a football player. I was going into my seventh grade year. He wanted somebody to ride his bike to tryouts with him. And I wasn't doing anything. So I said, I'll ride with you. And I'm sitting in the gym. The coach said, are you going to play too? And I looked around and he was talking to me. So I was, all right, I'll play. And that's kind of how I started playing sports. I was so bad in seventh grade football. It was two of us with the same number. And the other guy was the one who played. You know, the game was out of hand when I got in the game. And then I was started growing, and, you know, the basketball team came about. It was a little small town, 2A school. So I was approaching 6 feet at that time. So they put me on the team. I wasn't very good. Again, they kept me because I was kind of tall, and I guess I had some potential. And I'll never forget that seventh grade, we did homecoming during basketball season at that time. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't the worst player on the team, but it was 18 of us, and I was number 17. And because I was kind of tall, every once in a while in a blowout, he would throw me in the game. But homecoming game, you know, the game was about over, and he thought he had put me in the game, and he didn't. And he put number 18 in the game. So I was the only guy who didn't play our homecoming game in the seventh grade. And I was just so hurt and so angry at that moment. And that's what I started taking sports seriously. Mm-hmm. From that day, and I promise, from that day on, probably through my senior year of high school, I had a goal in my backyard, and I would play and I would shoot every single day. And my grandmother used to think I was crazy. It'd be raining, it'd be snowing, it'd be ice on the ground. And I just said, I'm always going to play. I'm going to find a way where the coach going to play me. I can't stand sitting. That junk hurts so much. So, you know, the next year I wanted to be in, like, the most improved player and started playing varsity at the end of my freshman year and things of that nature. But that was the moment that made me take sports seriously, was not playing that game in seventh grade.
And that kind of leads into our next question too, is obviously you went on to be a four-year player at Methodist and everything, and Elite Eight your senior year and all that type of stuff. What type of player were you?
It's funny how basketball has evolved. I was the ultimate role guy. I would do anything I could to get on the court. It's funny now, I'm a coach, and you try to tell guys to be happy, and if they're not playing much, things of that nature. But I was terrible when I was on the bench. I was the guy that wasn't engaged and things of that nature. And it's part of the reason what took me to coaching, because I learned from my mistakes. But as a player, I just would do anything I could to play. So if that means I had to guard the other team's best players, I tried to do that. If that means I had to just be really good at running sets, I tried to do that. If it means I couldn't take two or three shots a game, I would try to do that. So I never really got caught up in stats or the profile. I just wanted to be out there. All I cared about was being out there on the court. So I couldn't even tell you how many points I scored a game, and don't really care and never have. I just wanted to be out there on the court feeling like I'm making a contribution to it.
And then, you know, after graduation, you graduate from Methodist with a physical education degree. You go to Clayton Middle School. Then you go JF Webb High School to coach and all that type of stuff. Was coaching your goal, or was it more so teaching your goal?
A combination. I'm gonna go back for you a little bit. You know, I went to Fayetteville State first before I transferred to Methodist, and I matured a lot during that time when I got to Methodist College and things of that nature. And once I got to Methodist, I decided I wanted to try to give back to people like me, people that didn't come from much, people that didn't have much experience, or people around them that had college backgrounds. And that one took me to wanting to teach. And my goal at that time was I wanted to be a football coach at East Bladen High School, where I went to school. I wanted to be the offensive coordinator. So that one took me to go to education. I was like, I could help people like me get out of Bladen County and show them that there's a chance to go to college or something else in their lives. But once I got to the high school level, at Clayton Middle School, coaching both football and basketball, I learned that you can manipulate basketball a little bit more with your mind. In football, like if you're bigger, faster, and stronger in football, unless you just make some terrible decisions, you're going to win more football games than you're going to lose. Mm-hmm. And basketball, especially at the lower levels, there's no shot clock. So you could do stuff to kind of give yourself a chance. You ain't have to be the best team to win in basketball. Like you could learn the funky 1-3-1 zone, or you could learn four corners and hold the ball, or you could play fast. You could do anything you want to kind of give yourself a chance, regardless of talent. And that's what took me more towards the basketball side of things. Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, during that time, you know, obviously a young Andre Gray there coaching middle school and then high school basketball. What are some things that you learned during those couple of years that kind of still stick with you today?
The cool things is I still talk to, it's kind of wild. That was 23, 24 years ago. I still talk to some of those players, a lot of those players actually, from both my middle school team and my team at Oxford Webb. And just understanding that you can't always judge a book by its cover. You can't always judge somebody's future based on their past. We had guys that was like myself who didn't really have aspirations to go into college. I was the first, when I was at Clayton, I was the only black man in the school who wasn't a janitor. So those black young men looking up to me and seeing, hey, this is an educated black man. And I aspired to be that as well. I actually kept a couple of kids that's supposed to have been trouble kids, because I knew I could relate to them, and both of them wound up going to college at the end of the journey, which was really
awesome.
And then Oxford is kind of the same thing. You just want to try to give those kids as much hope as possible, especially coming out of those rural areas like that. But as I got to Oxford, I started working camps, and that's when the whole college thing started popping in my head. I had a kid that actually led the state in scoring at Oxford Webb, and guys coming in and recruiting him. And at the same time, I started working camps, and it hit me that maybe I could coach basketball and recruit my own players, recruit the guys I wanted to coach. So that's what took me to try to do college.
And then you jump into the college ranks. You go to be an assistant coach at your alma mater, Methodist, and all that type of stuff. What were some of your best and worst kind of memories of being a D3 assistant coach in the early 2000s?
I'll tell you what, it was awesome, man. Like I tell young guys all the time that I wish they could have some experiences I've had. The D3 world, I wasn't familiar with the levels. You know, I don't come from a college family, so I didn't understand the whole Division III, Division II, Division I stuff, you know. Mm-hmm. All I knew was that those kids went to school free, like I did. We had to take out loans. But I didn't have any idea how much money you can make in this business. I didn't understand the whole, like, some teams fly and others bust. That stuff didn't occur to me until I got into the business. And we had two teams. We had the JV and the varsity team at Methodist, and both men's and women's basketball both had them. And the rule was if the varsity team practiced first, the JVs had to practice last. And it was just two assistants. I mean, it was just one assistant that got paid, myself, and we had a couple of volunteers. And I was the assistant for the varsity and the head coach of the JV. So what happens sometimes, if the varsity practiced at 4, we would start JV practice till 11 o'clock sometimes. And I only made $2,000 for the year, spread over 10 months. So my checks is like $180-something. And my best recruiting job was my wife. She was crazy enough to let me pursue this business. So, you know, so we scrapped around trying to make ends meet. And I took a second job in Fayetteville. And that job, I had to be, is that Douglas Bird High School in Fayetteville. And I was the safe schools coordinator assistant, which meant glorified hall monitor. I broke up fights and wrote tardy passes. But I had to be there before the first bus got there. I couldn't leave till the last bus left. So most of the time, my days would start 6 o'clock in the morning at work. And my days wouldn't end because my JVs, I didn't understand, like, I wasn't going to short those kids. And this is my first opportunity to coach at college. So we would do full practices with those guys. Mm-hmm. You start at 11, you end at 1. You're the only assistant, so now you got to do all the laundry for both teams. You got to do all the recruiting. So I did a lot of my recruiting in between the practices and things like that. So my day was from 6 in the morning to 1:30, 2 o'clock in the morning. And I did that for a while. And I did, but the crazy thing is I was so ignorant to it. I didn't understand that's what – I thought that was all college coaches were doing. I didn't realize that was not the normal work day for college coaches. So by doing that early, it really was a blessing for me because it was cool. It kind of taught me the work and the kind of grind and the kind of how much time you have to put into this thing if you want to be good at it.
I'm sure, too, during that time you found the value of a quick 30-minute power nap in the parking lot.
I spoke about it. I actually, I could tell now I don't work there anymore, but I used to sneak them in between class. Like when classes were going on, when I was at Douglas Bird, I'll sneak them in every once in a while. I found me a nap spot in the auditorium at Douglas Bird.
And then from 03 to 07, you move over to Wingate, you know, a D2 in the SAC conference. What were the biggest differences that you saw going from D3 to D2, both in the recruiting style and kind of the type of player that was playing in that league?
Cool. The head coach at Wingate was kind of ahead of his time for this region, and that's kind of what led us to our success. Parker, he was awesome. But one thing we did at that level, we always told kids that they was going to pay a nickel out of their pocket if we put them on scholarship. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of unheard of in this region for Division IIs. Most schools would tell kids, hey, let's do this package, and then we'd kind of see what would work. We were sitting in the family, in the living room with a family, and say, hey, no matter what, we're going to pay for your school. You ain't going to have to pay a nickel. And it helped us get involved with some kids that we probably wouldn't have gotten involved with at that time. I think our last team there, we had two dudes that was All-American and two more that was All-Region, all on the same team. And I think a lot of that had to do with the way we was packaging and was recruiting guys. We were recruiting guys that we probably shouldn't have gotten. The biggest adjustment for me was at Methodist at the Division III level, because those guys not on scholarship, mm-hmm. Everybody in the gym every day was there because they wanted to be there, because there's nothing holding them to doing it. Like, they could just walk out the gym anytime they got ready and say, I'm done, and it wouldn't affect the scholarship situation. Mm-hmm. So those guys really love, just purely love to play the game. Part of the thing at Wingate when we first got there was trying to figure out the guys that loved it, who did it for the love, and who was doing it for the scholarship money. And that was one of the big things you had to figure out in the recruiting process as well. So that was probably the biggest difference. But the player-wise, we had some really good players at both places. I think we had guys at Methodist that go play at Wingate. We had some guys at Wingate that probably should have been at Methodist. So both ways. But as far as – that was probably the biggest difference. The Methodist kids, even our JV kids, man, they just loved it. They just loved – to say that it's part of a team that just love to play basketball in a competitive environment.
And then jumping on from there, you go on from Wingate, you know, you're at a D1 program for 10 of the next 13 years. Uniquely enough, every stop you've had has been to North Carolina. Has that been by design?
No, it hasn't. It hasn't been. And I only spent 1 year out of D1 now, but since I started now, I did the, at Winston-Salem. But, the last two jobs, I would say I actually kind of did on purpose. The last three start with the Winston-Salem State job. I started learning about the North Carolina retirement system. And some of my culture friends kind of get on me and tell me how smart I am for doing it this way. And to be honest with you, it wasn't done by design. I had no clue what I was doing. Mm-hmm. I took my first job at Clayton Middle School, and the people who does your benefits asked you, what you want to do with your retirement? And then again, I don't know. I didn't know. So I just say Penn State retirement plan. I didn't understand how to set up stocks and things of that nature. So, but being in the state so long, I started learning that I was accumulating years in the state system by staying in the system. So when we got let go at Wilmington, I had a couple opportunities outside the state of North Carolina at the Division I level. And it was kind of two-part. One part is I was really, really itching to become a head coach. I was getting frustrated with the the process, the schools that I thought I could be a good fit at, that wouldn't, I couldn't even get to the Final Four. I couldn't even get to the finalist list of these places. And I come to learn that at that level with the HBCUs, I'm talking about a lot of times the administrators will hire guys that don't have HBCU coaching experience because it's so different in their minds. So it was really frustrating to me. I was like, if I'm gonna have a chance to get the Fayetteville State job or have a chance to get the Shaw job one day, I gotta get some HBCU experience. And Winston State had a position open and the guy wanted the experience assistant. So from that dynamic, it made sense. Winston is a phenomenal job, one of the top five atmospheres in college basketball. You've never seen a game there, I suggest you go. So I was like, if I go here, we're gonna win. If we win, maybe I could have a chance at one of these CIAA jobs to open at that time. And then the second part was what you mentioned. It gave me another year in the state system. Uh-huh. I gambled on myself a little bit. I said, if I didn't like it, just like I did when I came into college, if I didn't like it, I figured I knew enough people, I had enough connections to get back to the PWI or the Division I side if I needed to. But I just wanted to gamble and kind of get a feel for working at HBCU at that time.
And then you mentioned too, getting let go. And all that type of stuff. That's got to be a unique situation, kind of for assistant coaches, because obviously you attach your wagon to a head coach, and the head coach is the one who's let go. Then obviously, conversely, you guys are too. What is that experience like, being let go for the first time as a college coach?
I mean, it was for me, it was crazy again, because I've got mentors now. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people in this business, they have mentors that of guys they played for, guys they worked for, things of that nature. I don't come from a basketball tree per se. So most of my relationships I had to build has been built from nothing. There's no commonality besides we hit off as people. Uh-huh. So when I was moving through the business, as you talked about, moving from Division III to Division II to Division I and going from Gardner Webb to Weston to Wilmington, and when I got to Wilmington, I kind of was in my mind, and it was totally wrong thinking I arrived. You know, I'm sitting there thinking like, man, I work for Buzz Peterson. Everybody know Buzz Peterson and friends with Michael Jordan. I'm part of the Carolina coaching tree now. I got me a tree. I'm close to home, moving on the beach. So I'm in my mind thinking I made it, like, and not understanding how this business worked at the time. So when we got the call, and we struggled a bit while we was there, but not to make excuses for it, but, you know, we walked into the APR mess and had to change kind of how we was recruiting and the guys we was getting. And the school had some financial difficulties while we was there. And I always use this example. We did a recruiting class that year of the three guys who didn't take official visits in the school. Mm-hmm. And one of them was the player of the year down in JUCOs in Florida, had Ole Miss and some other schools recruiting them. He came without an official visit. We had a kid that we beat Texas A&M and a couple of other schools for who came on an official visit. We had another kid who was a JUCO kid from Redlands out in Oklahoma who, you know, had some Missouri Valley offers and things of that nature who came on an official visit. So we was able to recruit some guys even though they didn't get to come officially because of budget restraints. But with that, I felt like our tenure there got cut short. But the bottom line of this business, you got to win. If you don't win, they're going to move you on.
Yeah.
And it's, you learn that, and I've learned it, and it's just something that you got to accept in this business. But I was actually in the road recruiting when we found out we got let go. And it's kind of ironic because one of my closer friends in coaching, I got let go a couple weeks before that. Uh-huh. And I remember having a conversation with him, and we was talking, and he was all depressed. And I was like, man, come on. Like, I'm coming down to Florida. Like, come watch this tournament with me, man. Like, you can't just sit at the house. You can't just feel sorry for yourself. Come hang out. We're going to watch these games. And we actually sit in the gym together watching a junior college tournament when I got the call that we was getting let go. And I was sitting there, like, trying to cheer him up. And I just got the call that we was fired. And I couldn't tell anybody because we wasn't supposed to tell anyone until we came out after our season. Because we still had games to play when we found out. So that – it sucked, man. It really was uncomfortable for me. I didn't know how to handle it because I had no prior experience with it. Coach Peterson was really, really good, helped me go through it. Houston Fancher was on staff, was really helped me get through it. I didn't understand why at the time because I thought we was doing everything they asked us to do. But at the end of the day, this college basketball comes down to winners and losses. And at the end of the day, it wasn't winning enough. But like I said, but I was happy. When we got let go, I didn't try to tell any of those kids to leave there. I knew that that core group of guys could have success. Now, were we the right guys to coach them? I don't know. But I knew we had enough talent on that roster to have some success. And they wound up having really good finishes to their career, which I was proud of, because those guys, they were some really good kids.
Mm-hmm. And then kind of on to a more upbeat type of situation. Your first year at Division I basketball at Gardner-Webb, you go to Kentucky and win at Lexington. That's got to be incredibly exciting and all that type of stuff. What was that experience like for you as a first year Division I coach and stuff? It's like, man, this is easy. We got this.
Oh man, that's exactly what I thought. I was like, hey, man, what this guy talking about this D1 stuff is all? Because I was a little frustrated when I was at Wingate about getting D1 opportunities. Like I was like, man, what the fuck, I can't get a D1 job, man. I'm killing it. We're in the Final Eight. I've got all these All Americans, and I didn't understand. So when I get my first chance at Gardner-Webb. Again, like third game of the season, I think it was. We go up and play, and that's when what's the tournament called? The 2K tournament. The NIT, preseason NIT. So we was the last team to actually where they changed the rule after our game. When we beat Kentucky, they changed the rule. Up until that point, they did pods. And the winner of that pod got to go to Madison Square Garden and play in the Final Four. And they always count on the top four teams, you know, the people that host the pods. Yeah. And we beat Kentucky that year, so we got to go to that pod. But I'll never forget. I mean, I was so scared before that game because that's the first time I've been in a big arena like that. I used to work camps now. I worked at Duke Camp and Chapel Hill Camp and some of those camps when I was a high school coach and coming up to the lower levels. But I've never been inside one of those arenas full. So I'll never forget, like, we out there doing the warm-ups. I'm sitting looking in the stands. I probably showed that. I probably think I'm back to cool, but I know I was so nervous. Oh, I was looking at all those people, all those faces, and I was like, wow, this is crazy. And they shut off the lights when they was getting ready to warm up. And you had to watch them do their little tip drill. And then when the lights come back on, their band was in the court blowing their horns in our ear and stuff. I was like, man, this is crazy. I was so doggone nervous. I remember when we came out for the last time, I was actually walking towards the Kentucky bench. For our coach, Doug Essa grabbed me, like, make sure I ain't walked. I was going to walk to the wrong bench before the game. But it was awesome. Like, that was such a good experience. Rich Scrooge was probably the perfect head coach for that situation because he didn't really get rattled much. And we really could shoot the ball. That team could. And we was up maybe 20 most of that game. So it wasn't like it was like a nail biter. Like, we beat the brakes off him up there that night. And it was fun. It was a really good experience. And I'll never forget, we got back to Gardner-Webb because we bust that game, Kentucky. And when we got back to town, it was on the 2 o'clock in the morning, and the sheriff was waiting for us, and they gave us an escorted ride, the last little leg to campus, and all the students was out in the parking lot waiting for us. And it was wild, because we were supposed to play the game maybe 2 days later after that. Mm-hmm. So the next day, we were supposed to have practice, and the student body actually did a pep rally during our so-called practice time. Yeah. So all we did was we watched the game on a big screen, with all our students in the gym for practice. That's what we did for practice the next day. So that was cool. It was a great experience.
I couldn't imagine. And then, you know, feeding off of that a little bit, you've worked, you know, with some great head coaches, you know, Buzz Peterson, Mark Price, Larry Hunter, Wes Miller, all that type of stuff. What are some takeaways that you've had from each coach, you know, kind of that took with you? And what was it like working? What was it like working for each coach? How are they different? Everybody's got a different voice, different way they want things. How are each of these guys different?
Well, man, I've been blessed all the way up. Like from Dave Smith and even the guys I worked with. Dave Smith down at Methodist, he was so cool for me and so influential on me because he allowed me to work. He let me figure out kind of what my voice was, let me coach the JV team. I was able to do anything I wanted with the JV team. So if I wanted to learn the new office, I actually been in the Princeton office my second year with those guys and learning the different zones and how to coach different things. He was real good with that. Again, his demeanor was really good as well, Dave's was. He never seemed to get rattled by the situation. He cared more about what our team did than the others. We did scout reports, but it wasn't really – he didn't care about details of it. He more cared about making sure we was running our stuff to perfection. So Dave was big time from that perspective. Parker, the other one, was at Wingate. Another one, he's very similar to Dave in that he let me grow. Mm-hmm. He gave me a heavy voice in the program. I did, at that time, did probably 90% of our recruiting. So I was able to sign guys without him even seeing them, which is kind of odd in this profession. So he helped me figure out to trust my own eyes. I would offer some guys sometimes that didn't have any other offers, and he was perfectly fine with that. He trusted that what I saw mm-hmm. fit his coaching style and fit his program. So Parker was big time, and our guys love playing for him because he let them play. I think part of coaching is knowing your personnel mm-hmm. and know who you are. You see guys sometimes fail by trying to be something they're not. But he was fine with it. Now guys play and make decisions and have fun and things of that nature. And that's why we had so much success there. Rick Scruggs was big time, again, because he was really good with our players. He was really good with letting those guys be who they were. Grayson Flitner, who a lot of people know, and Thomas Sanders, probably had two players in that roster. He didn't try to paint those guys in boxes. Thomas was a little bit of a wild card and didn't know what practice the greatest, but he wound up being player of the year in that league because Rick allowed him to be. He didn't try to pit him in a box. And the same with Flitner. Flitner didn't really care for the training of basketball, but he was a really good player. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing I took from Rick. He let each guy be what they were. Larry was definitely the most detail-oriented. What he did is he made me start watching the game where I paid a lot more attention to details of it. Mm-hmm. I think I'm personally cut more from the Parker and the Rick Scruggs and the Mark Price tree as a thinker. I was like, hey, give the best players the ball and just let them work. But that kind of made me think about the game on a different level. It made me think about, hey, man, like the angles of screens, the angles guys catching the balls, how guys are defending, the footwork they need to get shots off, the footwork they need defensively. There was never an I that wasn't dotted. It was a T that wasn't crossed in Larry's program. Like, he wanted to know everything. And it was really big for my growth, having to work day to day, because you have to think about everything. And before you even – we sit in a meeting, and before you made a statement or a suggestion, you better have thought it out. You better have, hey, this is why. You couldn't just say something. You had to have a why for why I say something. So Larry was phenomenal from that standpoint. But at the end, he let me, like I said, the last two classes there, like, I don't think he even seen the last class I signed play until they got on campus.
Yeah.
Buzz is like, he's real good for him. He was probably one of the best in-game guys I've been with. He wasn't as detail-oriented in preparation as a guy like Larry. Mm-hmm. But he did a really good job at, while the game is going on, he can make subtle adjustments. Being with Larry, you always like, you had a plan A. We didn't have a plan B because our plan A was so freaking good. Buzz wasn't scared to go to plan C if it thought it would work. And I always admired that about him. Like, he'd try stuff in the game that we didn't practice before. And so I loved him about that. And he was so helpful in the business side of the program. He taught me so much about the business of basketball and mm-hmm. looking at contracts and things of that nature. And me and Buzz got to spend about 2 months where it was just us. As a staff, it was just me and him. We had no other assistants. We had two GAs. Mm-hmm. We got really, really close during that time. And he's really helped me try to think about the business, the game as a business, which is also necessary. Fast forward to where James Wilhelmy, that was the first time I got to see somebody start from day one. Mm-hmm. So that was real, real important for my growth, I think, as well. I've never seen anybody start from the beginning. Everybody else that been with before that was experienced coaches. Mm-hmm. So watching him go through his hiring process of staff, watching him go through implementing his philosophies to the program, it was so helpful in my growth that way as well. Mark Price was the second guy I got to see do it from scratch. So kind of the same thing, trying to implement his system. His offensive mind is phenomenal. The way he could talk to our guys about reading screens and reading ball screens and things of that nature, I guess being one of the top point guards that ever play helps. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
but he saw the game at a different way from a normal person would. He would see everything that happened on the court a lot of times, and so that was the biggest thing he took away from Mark. He's a really good man as well. And now Wes is kind of wild. I ain't gonna say just because I work for him, but he's probably the best combination of all those things. Mm-hmm. He's really good with the guys. He's really good with basketball. He's super duper detailed. He's been good for me in this stage of my career because it brought me back to, like, Larry. It brought me back to making sure I'm mindful of what I'm doing, make sure I'm working on a day-to-day basis, make sure I'm working on getting better, because if you're not in this program, you're going to get left behind. because you know he's working. So you got to kind of, as best, try to keep up. You ain't going to surpass him, but you got to try to keep up with him. So it's been awesome.
And then kind of right now you're riding a wave at UNCG, a wave of success and up, just an upward trend. You know, you've been around, you know, basketball and all this stuff for the last 20 years or so in North Carolina. How special is it what you guys got going right now?
I'll be honest, it starts even higher than West. It starts with the chancellor. I think I said earlier, this school is wild how much they want us to be successful. They did everything that we need to help our guys get better. Mm-hmm. We want three schools. The only school I've been at, we have facilities that our guys have access to. We have full-time GAs. Our players always have access to any other thing that we need in our program to help these guys get better. They're going to provide. As far as even down to scheduling, strength coach, full-time strength coach, full-time trainer, whatever we need to help the program get good, become one of the elite programs, they provide for us. So,
what is going on, everybody? Jamie Shaw here. I'm very excited for you guys to get to listen to Andre Gray today, assistant coach, UNC Greensboro, Mr. North Carolina. Andre, how you doing?
I'm pretty good, but I don't know if I'm Mr. North Carolina anymore. I think you got that title now.
I'm
second in line behind you.
You'll always be Mr. North Carolina. But today I wanted to get with you. I wanted to talk with you about how to get recruited during a pandemic. We're in times right now that people haven't seen before when it comes to the pandemic side of things and recruitment and all that stuff. And I've been trying to put together a series of getting college coaches and what they're looking for and how they're navigating through it, because I think they're working through it just as much as the kids, the parents, the coaches, and all that stuff are too. So I wanted to get you on here to help kind of give some guidance to these people about what to do.
I think a lot of it, to be honest with you, Jamie, is the student athletes have to understand it. Us coaches are going through this for the first time as well. Mm-hmm. And how some schools are handling it, it's totally different. Like, and I just use our program, for example, at UNCG. We very much into people. We want to try to get to know those guys as much as we can. We like to have them around our players as much as we can. We like to have them come watch us practice and workouts. That's a big part of our sale, is how we do things and how we go about our approach on a day-to-day basis. So with that pandemic, that's taken that away from us. So we have to adjust how we're doing things ourselves. So the main thing I would suggest to everyone and everyone I talk to is just make sure you're doing as much research as you can. Try to get as much information as you can. Don't base a decision on a Zoom call, because during the Zoom, we're going to show you our best buildings. We're going to show you the nicest stuff. A lot of times, that's not what it's about. If you get a chance to drive by campus, even though it's a dead period and we can't deal with you, if you have a chance to actually see a campus in person, I think that always helps. I know for me personally, again, I'm a visual guy. And the moment I see campuses sometimes, I knew right away I don't want to be there. And that's something with this, without doing visits, are hurting some of these guys. So they really make decisions on, the coaches are kind of cool on Zooms. They're showing us really pretty pictures, and they have nothing else to base their decisions off of. And I think that's dangerous. We talk about the transfer pandemic, or whatever you want to call it anyways. And a lot of that, I think, is because those decisions were being made that way anyway. Guys are making decisions based on one-on-one relationships, based on jerseys, names on the front of the jerseys. Didn't really take a lot of time to dig in deep into what the program is about. And if you take the time to do that, I think it'd be less transfers.
And then kind of on the other side of things, the college coaches side of things, how are y'all going through finding players? Because obviously you have to fill out a roster for, you know, the upcoming season and recruit classes, and you're not able to get out to see these kids. How are you mining the fields to look for players?
One of the cool things about our program, we recruit this region. Mm-hmm. Very well. The last couple of classes we've been able to get done early. So most of our school years, we've been able to watch young kids. So a lot of the guys in these classes right now, we already know. We watch play games. We watch practice. We watch dual individuals. So for our program, it hasn't really hurt us yet, because we feel like we're ahead of most people anyway, at this level especially. We get ahead and try to identify as many guys as we can. And part of that is, you want to watch guys as early as you can anyway, because you want to see if they're getting better from year to year. So when you get a chance to watch a kid as a freshman, to watch him again as a sophomore and on, it helps us see if those guys have ceilings the ability to grow, the ability to improve their games, to pick up on things. So we've always tried to watch guys as early as we could anyway. Even if we're not actively recruiting them, we would start watching them early.
And then kind of going from there and stuff, all the kids are getting back playing, the AAU's going and everything, and there's live streams going on and all that type of stuff. Are you guys tuning into the live streams? Or is that helping and aid these kids' recruitments at all?
It is, absolutely. A couple of us on staff, the assistants, we actually watch them live a lot of times. Coach Miller, he actually does. We chop up the minutes of the guys we want him to watch, so he don't have to sit through all the warm-ups and things like that. So that's how he watches. He don't necessarily watch them live, but he watches film on almost all the guys that we're recruiting. And that's important for us because we want to be familiar with them as best as we can. The one thing that kind of hurts with the live streams is that you don't really get to tell what the player is about when he's not in the game, when he's not engaged in the game. And that's probably been the hardest thing for me to try to figure out, because we can't get in the gym and watch him practice with the high school team. We can't get in the gym and watch him do a workout with the assistant coach. And some of that stuff is very important. Watching them interact with each other is very important in the process to me.
And I agree with that. And kind of leaning on that a little bit too, as to what are some things that kids can do on these live streams during these games? Obviously, you know, play hard and do all that type of stuff. But, you know, as you say, interaction with the team, interaction with the coach, you know, that doesn't necessarily come through, you know, and when you have, you know, camera guys lagging behind and you're watching an empty half of the court. And what are some things that these guys can do during these streams to really stick out to college coaches and have them like, huh, who's this guy?
It's crazy how 20-some years, how playing hard is now a skill. It used to be something that you kind of wasn't expected to do. But
yeah,
the more you see a kid compete, and whether it's two of the top, suppose the top teams in the country playing against each other, or if you're playing against a team that don't have a name, who bringing it every day, who's playing hard, no matter who's the opponent, no matter what the score, that's the stuff that I kind of started watching as I started to watch more and more of these guys. I want to see who's playing well at 8 o'clock in the morning and at 4 o'clock in the afternoon when everybody's fresh. Because that's stuff that's the difference between winning and losing a lot of times. If you can't play hard when nobody's watching, you're not going to get the gym working your game hard when nobody's watching. If you're not doing that, you're not going to improve. So the guys that kind of play hard instinctively are the guys that I kind of more attracted to.
And then, and kind of talking with a lot of college coaches too, you know, during this pandemic and stuff, it's like, you know, they'll watch these AAU games, but they're not necessarily what they're leaning a whole lot on scouts as well as high school coaches, obviously to find out more about the kid, to deep dive about the kid, since you can't see all this stuff and interaction and stuff, you know, they want to, you know, college coaches want to find out more about the kid as to how the kid is, how he fits in culturally. You know, because there's nothing worse than landing a kid, recruiting a kid, getting a kid, and he's just a terrible fit for the program. And, you know, you have to have him for 4 years and it tears you apart and stuff. But deep diving on the background type stuff is more important now to a lot of these coaches, as they say, than actual the live streams and how they play on the floor. How have y'all done with that?
I think that's where our networks come in handy. In all of our relationships, we need people that's going to tell us the truth. Sometimes with the players in particular, they coaches and their families want what's best for them. So they won't necessarily tell you what their demons are. And the one thing that these kids and the families have to understand, we all have demons. We all have strengths. We all have weaknesses. And don't try to hide those things from each other, because if you do, once you become on campus and your demons show up, we don't know how to help you. So go somewhere that can handle your demons, wherever they are. But then the other part of that is, I try to have as many conversations with people around the areas that guys that coached against their kid. If I know somebody that from the school system, if I know a guidance counselor, if I know a teacher in that school, if I can find and get a hold of the athletic director at that school, I want to talk to as many people around that kid before I get serious about them, because they're the ones typically tell you the truth. Because they always want the kids to do well, but it's about the right fit for that university or that college. And you can't figure that out unless you do some research on the guys.
And then during this time, how would you suggest kids going about, or parents or coaches going about, like say they have a kid under the radar, maybe not playing right now, whatever the case, social media, emails, all that type of stuff. How would you suggest these people getting these kids kind of in front of you to say, hey, we play at 3 o'clock over on this stream. It might be worthwhile for you to watch.
Just like they do, just as much as they can email or hit us on our social media handles, I've always said to kids and families, like, as much as you can, try to use your real name on your Twitter handles. Because I know, like, for example, I was watching the tournament last weekend, and the kid popped up. I was like, oh, who's this kid? And the first thing I did, I heard his name on the podcast, on the web live stream, and I looked for him on my Twitter. And that's the way I always, I like to look for him on Twitter. I couldn't find the kid. Yeah. I couldn't find him. So I think it helps if you have a handle to use your real name as much as you can. Because that helps us find you. It helps us speed up our process. Now, of course, I called the coach and got the kid information, but I could have found that kid a little bit earlier if they used their real name on their social media handles. So that's one thing I think could really help. But just keep on emailing us. Just understand that most of us, we're getting 50, 60, 70 emails a day a lot of times from recruits. And we're going to prioritize it by year. Don't get frustrated if you're a rising sophomore or rising junior and you email us coaches and we're not responding, because most of us are watching the current class first. We're going to watch the 2021s before we watch 2022s. So it's not personal. Don't get frustrated with the process when God's not responding, but just understand that a lot of times we're getting, you know, 50, 60 of those things a day.
And then in shooting an email over to you or whatnot, what are some tips on the actual email? Like who do they email? What information? What's a good tagline, I guess, to put in the title of the email? Who to send it to? What's information to make sure you have in it?
The more information they can give us, the better, in my opinion. Of course, the real name, high school, if they're playing travel ball as well, get the information down. Because sometimes we can connect the dots that way as well. I like to, if they send me a highlight tape on with it, I would typically, if I like the highlight tape, then ask for full games. I won't watch a kid full game first. And it's just, and not just me personally, maybe some other coaches will. I want to see his highlights first, because then that would make me decide if I want to sit through a full game. And I say this a lot, like, just make sure the highlights match up to what they're supposed to be. If you're promoting yourself as a point guard, show yourself doing some point guard stuff. I'm not saying you can't be a scoring point, but also show yourself making some plays as well for others, because most people want their lead guards to kind of create for others as well. So, and if you're supposed to be a forward, I don't need to see a clip full of you dribbling the ball up and down the court. So just try to show your strengths as much as you can. Make us try to figure out what your weaknesses are. Mm-hmm. You see that a lot by kids. They show us their weaknesses too much. They're supposed to be a stretch four, and then they show themselves and they can't dribble. Like, dude, you can't even dribble. Are you a stretch four? Again, try to make your video match up to what your strengths are. And then we're going to figure out what your weaknesses are. And you never know, like, some schools could use you regardless of what your weaknesses are. Now, we can work on them, but just because you're not a great shooter don't mean we won't recruit you. Just because you don't have a great handle don't mean we won't recruit you, but we just want to know those things as fast as we can.
No doubt. And then kind of wrapping things up here, is there anything that you want to leave these people with, any words of wisdom or something we might not have touched on or anything like that?
The biggest thing with that is as we going through this pandemic, and, you know, everybody know me, I've been around for a while, and I have a lot of friends on the other side, like on the grassroots level and the high school level, and they're advising kids to take offers or commit to schools just because it's there. And for me, it's kind of scary. I would never tell a young person to take something just because it's there, as far as a decision like what college you go to, because the college decision is so important in someone's life. It's not only about the basketball, but a lot of times in life, that's where you meet your wife. A lot of times in life, that's where you're going to find your career after basketball. It's pretty much a lot of times where you're going to move back to after you graduate. So that decision is bigger than just your 3 or 4 years of playing basketball. So don't just take it because it's there. You either slice a piece of it because it's there. You don't make a decision that's going to affect the rest of your life because it's there. And don't be so worried about what the man next to you is doing. If you find a school that you love and it's the right fit, you go. But don't just take an offer just because it's there.
Mm-hmm. And then kind of finally here, you gave me 10, 15 minutes of this, and I thoroughly appreciate that. I'll give you a couple seconds here to tell the people what makes UNCG so special.
This is awesome. It starts at the top. Chancellor Gillum and Wes Miller and Kim Recker, they have a strong commitment to our men's basketball program. We are elite in our resources that we provide for our guys. We are elite in our preparation that we give to our guys. Coach Miller, it can't be anybody in the country that spent more time trying to figure out how to develop our players than him. Mm-hmm. It can't be a head coach in the country that spent more time with the players individually than him. And that's what makes us special. We really try to get to know these guys on the front end. And we get, I say a bad rap for being slow at recruiting and slow to offer sometimes. Because we won't offer a kid unless we have a plan for him. Mm-hmm. When we sit down with a family and give them a scholarship offer, we want them to know, hey, this is where we see you playing. This is the guys back at your position. This is how we're going to help you grow and reach your potential. We try to have those conversations with those guys on the front end. And because of that, I think we've had 3 transfers in 5 years. Because guys, when they walk into our program, they know exactly what they're walking themselves into. And they find out that coach is going to do everything he can to make them the very best version of themselves. And that's what makes our program great. And that's why we've had so much success. And that's where we're looking to build on in the future. So,
awesome. Andre, I want to thank you so much for joining us here today. I know that the people listening, all the coaches and parents and kids alike, greatly appreciate, this talk and this help.
No problem, James.
Guys, thank y'all so much for tuning in to the Absolute Basketball Experience. For Andre Gray, I am Jamie Shaw, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you.